So this is continuing with Jennison on 31st August 76. You were saying that Blackett...
Yes. Blackett provided us with the minimal... well, not with minimal, but with sufficient facilities to do the job. Obviously, we were not a full research team, but we were able to use the university van to go to the local countryside away from man-made interference. And we constructed an aerial system very, very cheaply indeed. An aerial system, remember, at 7 cycles a second. So this was really a downgrade coil with an iron core. Menzel and Salisbury, if I remember rightly, had used a big loop of wire buried in the earth or on the surface.
Oh, they had actually done something experimental?
They had done something experimental.
I thought they just suggested it.
I think that they'd actually taken a big loop of wire and picked up something like that. What I did was use you were almost already into the Hertzian dipole region, so it didn't really matter much what you did.
Right.
And I made a compact, nowadays, but rather like a ferrite cored aerial.
Right.
With packed galvanized iron wire, cut off 2 feet long, thousands of strands which would guillotine to that length, a big coil of wire around it, and then a synthetic receiver. I say it was synthetic because one, in those days, had not many of the modern techniques. We had a very lossy aerial coil, so I increased its Q by applying regenerative feedback to it. So the Q was artificially increased, made very high. But then I had to tune it.
Yeah.
So I, to make the capacitor, to tune it, I used the Miller effect and synthesized the capacitor. So one had both the inductance was artificially queued up, and the capacitance was artificially expanded in size by good old, very, very classical electronic techniques.
Incredible.
And that was a tuned circuit, virtually. The rest of it doesn't really matter. We used that apparatus in the distant, relatively distant parts of Derbyshire by using Blackett's van, and we detected various signals, but we were having trouble. There was still interference. Blackett recommended that we should try it at a place called Jodrell Bank, which was the botany department of Manchester University, where one of his staff, who was then a lecturer, perhaps a senior lecturer by then, I can't remember whether he was a lecturer or senior lecturer then, a chap called Level, had just started to put some trailers into a field, or he'd already got the trailers in the field, and was doing some experiments on meteor astronomy, where the environment was quieter than elsewhere.
Right.
So we took our apparatus to Jodrell Bank, and carried on our observations there, quite independently of Lovell's work, or anything else that was going on, but with the facilities available to us by grace of Blackett.
Right.
Lovell through Blackett, if you like. But,
so was there anything published of this, a report or anything?
Only a report to Professor Blackett.
Right, do you have a copy of this, perchance?
I really don't know. I think I might, actually. I've got a feeling that a few years ago, in churning over some old papers, I did come across it.
I'd love to see that, if you can
dig it up. I hesitate to... I can just tell you briefly that most of the signals we received were from fairly distant thunderstorms.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, very distant thunderstorms, I believe. And there did seem to be possibly a possibility of a leaky resonator effect going on, but I, without referring back to that very old paper, I couldn't tell you more. Well, this was a contact with Jodrell Bank, and as a result of that, both my colleague, who was a chap called W.A.S. Murray, and I... decided to continue, if we could be accepted, to continue doing research at Jodrell Bank after graduation.
Right.
And that indeed we did. W.A.S. Murray turned up at Jodrell Bank to start research shortly after I did, a week or two later, so that I had first pick on one of the two research projects which were available. One of the research projects was on lunar radar. The other was concerned with a newfangled interferometer that Henry Brown had just thought up.
This would be 49 that you
This would
began?
Be 50.
50. Okay.
And I opted for the interferometer. It just intrigued me because I rather liked techniques one way or another, and I got a bit fed up with radar.
Right.
Done enough. And it just seemed something different. So I opted for that one, and my colleague W.A.S. Murray did the radar, moon radar.
I see.
Have you, incidentally, just switching quickly, have you been in contact at all with W.A.S. Murray?
No.
Have you got any references on his work?
Well, I have references. Where is he now?
He is now the head of the department, not the head of the department, but the equivalent. He's the, what's it called now? It's the head of the physics division at RARDE. It's Civil Service Royal Armaments Research and Development Establishment. Not far from Canterbury, at Fort Halstead,
Fort Halstead,
okay,
near Sevenoaks in Kent.
I'll get that address from you afterwards.
Okay.
He incidentally had a lot of trouble on Moon Radar. He was getting very worried. He had a bit of a breakdown, but then everything seemed to fall into place. He found, I think he was the first one to do this. Bay had already got lunar radar results.
Right.
But it was Sandy Murray, who, because he couldn't understand why his signals were doing funny things, found that it was a Faraday effect affecting the signals coming in.
In the ionosphere. Okay.
That's right, it was a Faraday effect. It was twisting the polarization around.
They're using linear feeds.
Yes, they were using linear feeds for the first things. And so Sandy put it down to the Faraday effect in the upper atmosphere.
Who was it that really got the lunar radar going at Jodrell?
He was the first chap to get the lunar radar results at
Jodrell. I see.
Yeah.
So,
but he was followed by...
Evans.
Was preceded by a chap called... Yes, Evans went to town with it.
Right.
But it was Sandy Murray who actually got it going.
I see.
Yeah. Yes, Evans went to town with it and refined it, sophisticated it. So. Right.
Now, what about this...
back to me.
This weird interferometer that...
Henry Brown's interferometer. Well, this was fascinating. I was intrigued by the principle, and I was intrigued by the challenges of electronics of it. I was still, to some extent, a bit of a radio engineer. I'd been a radio ham, incidentally. I think I still was at that time. And I liked the idea of doing things like that, so I got into that. That Hanbury had put it to me. He left this almost entirely to me. It was, one often wonders whether one should leave research students to themselves,
right,
or, you know, guide them all the time. Yeah. Hanbury left this surprisingly to me in the circumstances, in retrospect, I think. He was doing experiments of his own at the time on the 218-foot fixed radio telescope, and was quite absorbed with those, and so that the actual work for the development of the principle that he enunciated was left almost entirely to myself. And so I constructed a prototype instrument, and we tried it out on the sun. This would be in 1951. 1951 was roughly a sunspot minimum, and we expected the sun to be quite quiet. I designed a set of aerials for this interferometer, which were very large. They were 120 feet long and 40 feet wide, and they could be tilted over towards Cygnus, which is 15 degrees from the zenith at our latitude, or towards Cassiopeia, which is 5 degrees the other way. And this big bedstead array had to be made in such a way that it could be transported to various sites over the countryside. And this was quite a challenge, just as a bit of cheap engineering.
This was to get very variable length
baselines.
You thinking variable orientations might be valuable at that time?
I hadn't thought about it, but variable length baselines were the main thing at that time. So, but the main challenge there was how the heck did you produce an aerial that size? It had to be that size, essentially, because as you probably are well aware, the intensity interferometer depends very much on the strong signal.
Right.
The signal noise ratio has to be essentially the order of unity or greater, otherwise you start to lose severely, it goes down as a square.
And you realise this even before, theory even before...
Yes, indeed, I think Hanbury may well have pointed that one out to me. And so I had to make very big aerials. It was much bigger than those, for example, used by Mills and so on when he did his extended baseline surveys around about the same time.
Right.
And so these very large aerials were constructed in such a way that they could be collapsed. They were, I've forgotten how many elements, but they were collinear broadside arrays of many, many elements, tuned to 120 megacycles, I think, in the first place. And the whole pack of cars could be collapsed and dismantled and packed onto a single lorry. And one could move them around the countryside that way on. And then reassemble them. Later we were able to reassemble them in about one day, even collecting all the feeders. But initially it took 2 days, I think, to reassemble. Now we used a quarter of these big aerial systems for the solar measurements to establish whether or not the intensity interferometer principle would really work.
Right. And what sort of the baseline?
That baseline was trivial. Hundreds of yards, 100 yards, hundreds of yards, that sort of baseline. No more than about 100 yards, if I remember rightly. And we measured the angular diameter of the sun. At least we tried to, but there were sunspots. And even the smallest sunspot gives you an erroneous answer.
Yes. Yeah.
And still, we did it, actually, and I had thought we'd publish that result. We probably didn't.
It's in my thesis,
it's in lots of other things. I don't think we published it because somebody else, was it Machen or somebody other at Cambridge, had been measuring the angular diameter of the sun, but it was one of the early measurements of the angular diameter of the sun. and it was quite a good one.
Or of some spice, do you mean?
Well, it was the sun, because we waited, and that's why we took so long. Otherwise, we'd been long ahead of the other chaps doing the Cygnus and Cassie beer measurements.
I see.
Because we were troubled by these darn sunspots, and we wanted to make quite sure that the fundamental equation of the intensity barometer was really right. I mean, nowadays it seemed obvious it's right, but in those days you had to be quite sure. So we really had to make sure that our transform of the sun really did go down to the zero and so on. And this took a lot longer than we'd expected.
As you were working on this, did you have any doubt that the thing would finally work? I mean, did you become convinced that the principle was sound and so forth?
I had trouble. Was it almost sound? Initially, the original plan was just to multiply the signals together, coming out of the two channels interferometer, and we tried the ordinary principles of multiplication of signals as we know in those days, and we couldn't get a really positive result out. Then we decided to phase switch, what's the right word? I think you'd really call it phase switch. Yes, phase switch. It's a different way to, this was phase switching actually before Martin Riles, but it's different. We weren't phase switching at RF. I put a switch into the lead of the, just before the signals multiplied together.
Right.
I put a switch, one of these quick make break QMB switches, into the lead to that, and I reversed the sense of the signal. And I spent about 2 hours, an hour and a half to 2 hours, one day, whilst the sun was transiting, with my watch in one hand and the switch in the other, flicking the switch every 2 or 3 minutes.
Oh, I see.
This way, and then that way, and then this way, and then that way. And out came a beautiful record in the form of a square wave.
You were beam switching, really.
Not beam switching. Phase switching, actually. Strictly phase switching, but not synchronously rectifying to the phase switch. So the signals were adding in one sense, subtracting in the other sense, but instead of synchronously detecting, which you do on a real phase switch interferometer, and gives you this sort of thing, I just saw the sum and the difference. The sum and the difference superimposed on the bump due to the total power.
Right.
So that the bump of the total power now had a big square wave going through it, almost down to zero and almost up to the top. And we measured the depth of modulation of my switched waveform as I threw the switch one way or the other. And the depth of modulation gave the visibility.
Right.
Okay.
So this is very, very analogous to Riles.
It's extraordinary. Now I think about it now, it is the same thing, apart from the fact we didn't put the synchronous detector at the end.
Now
at that stage, we did do later.
Was this used? I mean, is this published anywhere? This description of this?
No, it's in my thesis.
Okay. Yeah.
And in Dasgupta's thesis, probably.
What about this fellow Dasgupta? You haven't mentioned him yet.
Oh, I will willingly. I'm sorry, I should have mentioned Direl Das. Das. I had been on the job for the interferometer for about 3 months, 2 months perhaps, when I was told that an Indian fellow was coming along, a chap with an MSc from Calcutta, and he gave me a hand on this. And this was Das, and we became very, very firm friends, and a very, very nice chap. And we worked together throughout the whole of this phase on that system. Das, coming from India, loved to go out and work on the aerial systems when it was snowing or freezingly cold.
Which
I used to love to go out into the sunshine and work on them then, and spend the rest of the winter time fiddling with the electronics inside. And that's the way we sort of divided the operations. So, yes, Das and I were together on the home of this, not so really. And
back to the experiment.
So back to the experiment.
Did you get fringes immediately with this thing? I mean, as soon as you got it working to the stage where you thought you should get them?
We had no fringes until we'd used this switch, which we threw. Well, sorry, the system doesn't produce fringes. No obvious correlation. Until I put in this switch, and then yippee!
Right.
We saw the thing really working.
Right.
It was marvelous. I mean, there it was. We'd actually got the intensity interferometer doing an intensity interferometer thing. And also we'd got, the whole thing of fixtures.
Right.
So at that stage, then it was a case of refining things.
Right. When was this when it first worked?
It must have been sometime in 51. I'm sorry, I can't tell you without looking back at the old records. Sometime in 51. And we had the system going in 51 sometime or other. We couldn't go straight onto the Cassiopeia and Cygnus because it had to be proved that it would measure the angular diameter. You had to prove the equation. Okay, the visibility function is the square of the normal visibility function. We had to prove that. We had the system going. We had to then measure that. That's when the delay came with the sun. Okay. But immediately after doing this switching business, of course, we then refined it and put a phase sensor detector on the end, and we got a pump coming out in the usual, clean, more sophisticated way of ordinary systems nowadays.
Right. Okay. Was this, that was, were you aware of RAL's work when you made that improvement?
Not then.
Was it only a matter that when the proceedings of the Royal Society, whatever it was, paper came out that you heard about this, or did you hear about RAL's phase switching through some other channel?
Yeah. I think it came, look, I'm awfully sorry, I just cannot remember.
Came out in 52.
Came out in 52. This was certainly before that. I think it was, one was influenced much more by Dickey's paper. Because all we did was do what Dickey did.
That's right.
Really.
It's
the same principle.
Right.
I don't think it was RAL at all. I don't think he came into it.
Except it's not microwaves, yeah.
Yeah, it was the Dickey system, virtually, but we were using it to switch the phase rather than to do that. And we weren't doing, as I say, quite what Martin RAL did.
Yeah, right.
But it so happens that the technique is almost the same thing. We were doing it right at the end of the system. What Martin RAL did was put it at the front end of the system,
virtually. In all of the solar work that you were doing to check out the principle, it's not published anywhere but your thesis, you said.
Mm.
I'll have to check
that's
it out.
That's right, yes. There was, I think Lovell was a little bit reticent those days about publishing that sort of stuff, and as I say, Machen already published something about the sun, and so it's, as far as I recall, we didn't publish
it. What was Lovell's criterion for something that should be published?
He was a hard taskmaster on that. I remember I was put off writing papers for many years because he was so critical before a paper could be released. How it should be written. It's very good, actually, but it did mean you almost held up, and this is a little later on, actually, but one tended to... perhaps you went a little too far, so to say.
Yeah.
A little too far.
So what you're saying is that you had very high standards for the
very
paper,
high standards.
And also that it had to be something that was sort of significant, not just...
That's right, yeah. He would be hesitant about... certainly, sometimes were something was highly original, perhaps, in case it might be wrong.
So it had to be checked out in many ways.
That's right, yes.
Well, what about this paper as an example, though? Your 52 paper.
Oh, yes. Well, let's see now.
That's rather highly original, to say the least.
Well, he believed it. That's all. I think that's all written. He believed it.
Okay.
Now, let's see then. We spent a long time doing the sun. I mentioned that two or three times, but I better just reiterate it, because that's why we were so long getting going on Cassegrain and Cygnus, which was the main object of the exercise. But having... in order to do the sun, I can fix the date pretty well for you. We must have done the sun during the summer of 51 and the autumn or fall of 51 into the early winter, at least, of 51.
Right.
The reason I can fix it, very simple. My aerials were designed to tip a certain way over. I had some tripods made, some wooden tripods about 6 feet high, so that I could put the center point of the... They rocked over, 15 degrees one way, 5 degrees the other. But I was able to put the center points up on these 6 foot tripods so that they'd tilt over further to see the sun.
Right.
But as the weeks and the months went by, the sun got too low, and I couldn't get my aerial learner.
Right.
So I think I even put tripods on top of tripods and got the aerial very steep. Ultimately was not sufficient. And I had to dig a trench, or Descutter and I dug a trench, and I often, not often, but occasionally quote this to my research students nowadays, what they must be prepared to do. We dug a trench, ultimately about 6 feet deep, and 3 feet wide, in the soil of one of the fields of Jodrell Bank. At that time it wasn't our field, it was a field adjoining Jodrell Bank owned by one of the farmers, but we got his permission. We dug this big trench, 40 feet long, or thereabouts, 6 feet deep, 2 or 3 feet wide, and dropped the end of the aerial into the trench so we could see further and farther over.
Yeah.
That's right.
Amazing.
Now, and then we completed the solar runs on that. And so that would place it at the end of 51 when we completed the solar runs. I think we might have gone into the following year. We then had to construct the larger aerial systems, the rest of the aerial systems, and to use on Cassegrain and Cygnus. And so during 52 we set up that. I had to make, that's right, radio links. I had to send the signals back by radio link from the distant sites of Cassegrain and Cygnus.
Oh, I'd forgotten that was involved.
Yes, of course. Yes, for the sun, we could do it by cable.
Yeah.
Now, whether or not I built the radio links so it sent to that point and used it over 50 yards, I really don't know. I rather doubt it, but I may have done.
Yeah.
But I certainly had to build up radio links to bring back signals from the proposed Cassegrain sites.
Did
now,
Did this create problems?
No, I've been a radio ham. I love the job. Yeah. And I was talking to Bernie Mills only a few days ago, and I was just mentioning something about Radio Links, and how I had a problem with those members of my staff who were from Cambridge, who wouldn't touch Radio Links sound, and how we used to throw them together in the old days, and Bernie was agreeing with entirely.
Right.
You know, one just did it, and one would still do it.
Yeah.
And that's what they thought I did. It was a nice bit of fun. One just made a Radio Link.
Right.
And but I thought that I'd have to go 50 miles or 100 miles to measure Casper Cygnus. That was the thoughts in those days.
Based on what?
Based on the fact that everybody was thinking these were stars. These were the radio stars. The word was in use then.
Right.
Okay, the radio stars, because you couldn't resolve them. Therefore, you had to go at least 50 miles or something like that. But who knows how far?
Maybe you didn't know about it, but Smith came out with his precise positions in September 51 or so, summer 51 in Nature.
Yep.
Very soon thereafter, Botta and Minkowski got the identifications, which were,
yes.
Well, Cygnus, of course, was still a very small thing optically, but CAS was sort of a filamentary thing over the largest region. But you were still thinking that...
Yes, now, the first indication we had of Cassiopeia was Dewhurst, Cambridge. It was his...
That's true.
Dewhurst was the chap. It wasn't Bottom Kosky.
Well, yes.
He got the top filament.
Right,
he knew there was
him,
something extended there.
But it was off from the radio position, and therefore...
Yeah, it was
said,
the top bit.
That's funny.
I think that I at least thought that Dewhurst was onto something. I don't remember the date. Graham Smith's positions were not important to our work. They were important to Barnard and Minkowski.
Yes.
And to Dewhurst.
But the point is that there was an identification with some wispy extended stuff.
Yeah.
And now, you must have known about that, and yet you were still thinking that Cassiopeia was a...
But what I can't remember is the date when the Barnard and Minkowski paper came out.
Oh, the paper is much later.
First indication.
But the news is September 51 is when they...
Was it?
They went right on the telescope. The 200-inch in the fall of 51.
Right, okay, yes, this could well be so then. In the fall of 51, yes, it could be so. It doesn't track what I was saying before. We had thought we'd need long-distance radio.
When you were starting out in the project, right.
Yeah. And there was no reason to change those plans, really. So the radio link was capable of doing much more. I think in later years, I remember... expression of Hamburg is when we did resolve the lighters, he said we'd use a steamroller to crack a nut.
Yeah.
That's right, okay. we had something that was much more powerful at the end, and we were prepared to go further. I don't remember exactly when the news filtered through about these optical observations or how it influences.
Well, but
forgive me, I forgot.
But you may well, even though you had this filamentary stuff, you may well have said the radio source is still a very small thing and there's these optical filaments around. They don't have to be the same size.
Yeah, we probably did. It's too long ago, I'm sorry.
Right.
Can't remember. Okay, sometime then, in 52, and again I can't remember when, we went the whole hog. We put our first aerial system up in the... big aerial system in the grounds of Lovell's house.
I see.
The Quinta, which is 3.5 kilometres south of Jodrell Bank.
Right.
And we tried it over that baseline from a small cornfield, really, I suppose it was, to the side of his house, belonging to him. We set up the aerial system there, we transmitted the signals back by radio link, and we got the whole thing going over that baseline. And on that baseline, as you see now, well, we got... What did we get? I think the Cygnus did not appear to be resolved, probably, to any extent. And that Cassiopeia was looking as though somewhat resolved. Let me see. We were south, so in retrospect I could work it out, probably. We were 2.5 kilometres south. The minor axis of Cygnus is that way on, yes. So on the diagram in the 51 paper, 52 paper, 52 paper,
right.
That first measurement would be this one, the Cygnus, yes, test resolved, and Cassiopeia quite well down on the thing. And we made that measurement, checked everything out, and thought, well, okay, we've got something, literally, I think we just thought that. What does it look like other ways? We just directed ourselves that way on. This is quite different to what Graham Smith and Mills had done. They carried on the same direction.
East-west.
That's right.
Right.
We... got that measurement and thought, well, what's the next sensible thing to do? And instead of going along the same line, we turned around.
Yeah.
The first time it's been done. That's right. And So we and then we decided the way to do this was 3 axes across 60 degrees. So we then looked for suitable sites at the same space distance, I suppose, 3.5 kilometres or something. It probably said here. It must have been, I think, the same distance away. And we turned around at the same distance away. The great problem, of course, was to put a big aerial system up in the direction at which you wanted, at the baseline that you wanted, when you'd land right on top of some cows or some farmer's field, whatever it was, where you might not particularly want to.
Right.
But we managed to do it. We managed to get aerials sufficiently near the right positions and did measurements at least two other directions. Cassiopeia made sense. We got this roughly circular distribution. Cygnus didn't make sense. The three measurements did not fit together, but we had confidence in our measurements. We were sure we'd done them right. So the fault wasn't ours. Cygnus had to be wrong somehow. There's something peculiar about the distribution.
Now, what exactly do you mean was peculiar then?
Well, the fact that the measurements on the three baselines did not fit a single, what shall I call it, monotonic distribution.
An elliptical shape.
An elliptical shape could not be fitted.
Right.
Okay. And in fact, no ordinary regular shape, singular shape,
right,
would fit the results. And that glared out at me at least on my initial measurements. Again, I think because one had faith in one's own measurements.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas somebody else looking at it might say, oh, well, they made bad measurements. Look, yeah, those don't make sense. That one's too short compared to the other two, and you right, can't project it that way.
Yeah.
But the fact that if you take a single object with only one maximum, and if you rotate around it, you must always get a projection of that distribution, that wouldn't work with the measurements we'd made.
Right.
And with the confidence of these measurements, something else had to be the cause. And but just going back one, I noticed that in these measurements, they were, for what they are, remarkably correct. As I say, the visibility functions measured, or the square of the visibility functions
right,
were measured, was remarkably correct. It just didn't make sense. Cassiopeia, again, is quite remarkable. I see what we quoted in this paper, the equivalent angular size of the source appears to be about 4 minutes of arc. I think the current value, according to the frequency you're on, is around about 4.1 minutes of arc.
Right.
It was extremely close. And it was, we said, enough to circular. It was in a later paper that I think I pointed out for the first time, it was the phase-sensitive measurements that I did a little later, that it was limbrightened, which was long before Martin Ryle, of course, did his synthesis on it.
Right.
That was Cassiopeia. Now, Cygnus. All right, something funny was wrong there. So, I've told this tale before, and it sounds silly, but it's perfectly true, that the... I took a long bath, and it sounded like Archimedes, but I took a long bath, and I lay back in the bath thinking about this distribution. All of a sudden, it clicked that if this thing, Cygnus, were two blobs instead of one, then I could get this peculiar difference between the projections in different directions.
Right.
Now, it seems rather remarkable that one got it from that, whereas nowadays one interprets that usually from such things as the height of the second maximum of the transformer.
Sure.
But my information was from an entirely different source, just making sense of an irreconcilable distribution in three different directions.
Sure.
And so I just thought of the model that did it. And then, presumably having gone out of the bath, I probably did a quick calculation, tried out what would happen if I took a simple distribution like that, a model-fitting thing, right, and found it would project that way, indeed. And then the next thing was to do to see whether I was right. So we decided were, according to this, these three axes that were taken, where the most likely major axes lay.
Right.
And we decided it would be around about a position angle 113 degrees, I think. And I don't know if I say it here, but we'd probably say it here. Anyway, I think right about 113 degrees. 120 degrees, was it? 120, 113. It's,
as far as I remember, it's around about that.
And then what was the test observation you were going to
make? So then, the thing to do was now find the distribution along that axis. Now that comes after this first paper, but perhaps at this point, let me just mention my colleagues elsewhere in the world.
Right. Now, did you know about their work as you were working on
this? We knew on the grapevine that Mills was doing something. Some visitor from Australia said, oh, Mills is building an interferometer also to look at Cassiopeia and Cygnus. To look at Cygnus, I'm sorry,
right,
not look at Cassiopeia, I could see Cassiopeia, Cygnus. Cambridge have always been very secretive. It was very difficult to find. This is always been so, and always will be so, I think. Good luck to them,
but that's the way they work.
We knew that Smith was doing something around that. He had been doing the police investments. It sort of filtered out. He was probably looking at the Anglicises, but on fairly short baselines, the top bit of the transfer. I don't really remember much more in detail, just that we thought that he was doing something. Now, what did happen next?
Well, Henry Brown has told me that at the ERC meeting...
He went to Australia.
The ERC meeting, this set of three papers was set up. It would be nice to publish them together.
Yes, what happened, I think, was that probably Smith... Well, Mills was obviously at the ERC meeting. Right. Smith probably went there. Right. Henry certainly went there. When Henry left for Australia, we hadn't got a measure. We were all ready to take it. We hadn't actually got the measure.
I see.
And so we promised Hanbury that as soon as we got something, we'd send him a cable. And we sent Hanbury a cable somewhere about halfway through the ERC meeting, I suppose it was, quoting what we'd measured for the two sources.
I see.
Okay? And he received that in Australia, and then I think the decision was made at the ERC meeting that all three should be published together. But it just arrived in time at the ERC meeting by cable. In fact, I remember Hanbury sending back querying the word I'd used, which in retrospect was a little chosen word. I said equivalent line diameter of the sources or something. What I intended was equivalent strip diameter. Just taking it as equivalent strip. And I used the word line, and Hanbury put back on the was this word line right or something like that. But that was the state of the art then, which probably takes us now to the Cygnus distribution. Does it anything else like that?
Well, I was just wondering how
can I have another bite?
Yes, go right ahead. I was just wondering how you looked upon these other results when they became available to you in late 52. Did it all seem like everybody was agreeing?
Oh, near enough, yes.
Yeah.
Bernie Mills had been unfortunate, if you like. He jumped too far in his
measurements. Exactly.
And,
he almost got it.
He almost got it. He went too far and assumed something, a little training from... was it my training in those days? My own training. I think I taught myself it. About model fitting and so on, and jumping to conclusions with plots. It's very, very easy to think that something is due to an error, and so on sometimes, or in your own work, and not attach significance to something that's not quite right. Okay, as with the Cygnus distribution, it's very, very important sometimes. I'm talking generally now, very quickly.
Yeah.
I've seen chaps miss very important results, because they decided that their measurements weren't quite as good as they thought they were, and they've drawn the mean line through the points instead of making that little dip or little peak or whatever it was, in having courage and their own convictions that they'd done the right measurements.
Right.
And it's terribly important.
Supposing Jansky hadn't followed up this little history.
That's right. Yep. Very, very important. There's the principles of measurements that one should, if one really believes one's done the job properly, believe one's self and accept it and see what it means.
So do you think that may be a component, though, is that many people don't have the confidence that they really have been that careful, and therefore...
It's surprising how many people do not have confidence, and over the years, since these early days and so on, the number of times I've had, for example, very good research students or members of staff, who very good in the sense that they were marvellous analysts and so on, who would never dare, if you understand what I mean, they would never dare to push something with the courage of their own convictions or whatever it was, because they thought, always think that somebody else must have observed it, or somebody else must have thought of it first, or as it happens a large number of times. Curious enough, with some of the best chaps that do the analytical sort of work, they haven't got that curious flair which says, damn it all, I know I'm right, I've got to go that way, however away from the mainstream it may seem to be.
Do you think experimentalists maybe have this more in their blood?
Yes, but again, some experimentalists, and there are those experimentalists, especially, for example, take radio astronomy, present-day radio astronomy, so much of it is just plugging into a big instrument and plugging out the data.
Yeah.
Okay, it's a very, very different world, except for the odd little things that are still going on here and there, thank God. Well, if you like, the pulsar business, they believed in the end that those were real pulses, and so they're coming from outer space. So it's the same old story. You could just as much as interference. Going back to Jupiter. So,
the only one from that. There have been many, many cases, and it a lot depends, I think, in these cases, who is there at the time. If you've got, I mean, so many, so often, some people may have missed these things because they're the wrong type of person to appreciate.
That's right.
That the signals concerned, the visual concern, were really significant.
They're more concerned with getting the data to fit their preconceived notion
rather
than seeing what the data says.
Yes, yeah. Anyway, we're drifting completely. What do you want to ask me?
No, this is very useful information, indeed. Well, now you followed this up and went along the expected position angle.
Yes, with the intensity interferometer, went along the expected position angle, and indeed, up popped the second maximum as predicted by my model. And and the first minimum we looked at rather carefully, and it did seem to be very low. This was fairly important because one of the main differences between two and a three body problem is the depth of that minimum, and also the symmetry of the source is governed by the depth of that minimum.
So you were still open that there might have to be three or four components?
One had to be certain that if one was going to publish something about it being two components, it was two components.
Yeah.
And with the intensity interferometer, you could only go as the square of the visibility function, so you could not investigate at the minimum so well as you could with an interferometer. For example, a 10%, what would it be now? It goes to the square, so if we got down to 1%, we couldn't be 10% on an interferometer. So one had to measure very carefully there, otherwise it could be checked out by somebody else with a different system that you were in error. So, and again, with this, I've already mentioned how careful one had to be about publishing in those days, one had to be quite sure. And spent some time making quite sure, as near as we could with that system, and I did something then for the first time, I think. This was like one of these little bursts in radio astronomy. Yeah. I couldn't move my big aerial systems very easily over short distances.
Yeah.
So I did a trick. I changed frequency by a small amount.
Oh, I see.
Right? I changed
so
frequency. Yes, I changed my frequency about 5%, either way.
Yeah.
And this gave me an equivalent shift. Now, I was talking to somebody at this conference, I've just forgotten who it was. Was it dear old chap who first discovered these Jupiter bursts? What did he?
Burke, yes,
Bernie Burke. He told me he was using two of my things. He's using my three-station interferometer system at the moment, and I think he also said he was using the baseline change. It may not have been he, maybe it was somebody else. Sorry, forgive me, it may well have been somebody else who was doing it. Bernie's suddenly using the three-station interferometer. But somebody else is using the same trick. Said, "Oh, you were the first chap to think up the."
Right.
It seems so silly and so trivial. Yeah. But it was just because it was so darn difficult to move the aerials that I was forced into changing frequency, which is all right as long as you've got a well-behaved function with frequency, which it did seem to be. Now, at that point, I was probably influenced by Mills and Smith, that as their results didn't differ greatly, it didn't matter very much changing frequency slightly.
Yeah.
Okay.
That may well have been about the spectrum of the sources.
Yeah. But we're getting the same order result, therefore I could change. I could risk changing frequency slightly.
Yeah.
And I did this along the visibility function, so instead of getting a single point at each thing, I got triplets.
Right.
Oh, usually triplets, maybe or some of double.
Can we just look at that?
That gave me a gradient, incidentally. The gradient's very useful. Okay. Sorry.
Yes. Can we just look at that second paper and see if there's any points
Is it there? Okay, let me see. There's a triplet, and there's a triplet.
Right.
Okay. And you see the gradient. Right. Don't ask me why we took that zero there when that point's just above it. I'm sure we had good reasons for it. But sometimes in the scientific paper, one does not publish all the feel one has, all the sort of information one's got in one's guts, if you like. And we were absolutely certain that went down. I remember arguing about it with my colleagues at the Arden conference, and so on, that was well under the 10% visibility function. In other words, I'd then be talking about 1% in the square of the visibility
function. Right, right.
And I was quite sure of it. Because one of the chaps who didn't believe this result for years was Bracewell.
I see.
Bracewell, of course, very keen on his Fourier transforms, and so on. Looking at the thing from entirely the other point of view, if you take the Fourier transform of the objects, then you can have an infinity of objects which satisfy our points. Whereas this was done the other way around by model fitting. But again, it's one of these curious situations where one is armed with a lot more information which doesn't directly come out. You have the distribution around the source, the first one set us onto the track first of all, together with the visibility function, you say. And I could not see that the three-body problem, which was
fill this in or mark this as a symmetrical one, would satisfy the results. I was absolutely convinced that it was two bodies.
You weren't trying to do two-dimensional Fourier transforms, so that was too complex to think about.
We worked the other way around. We thought of a model, analyzed it. You cannot work backwards with those few points. There are too few.
Yeah.
You just get too many possibilities. It's far, far better, I think, to start with a model, because the model has to satisfy this visibility function along the major axis, as well as satisfying the projection along the three axes.
Right.
And that restricts the model quite a lot. And I remember arguing with Bracewell about a possible bridge in the middle. In fact, I think it was a Cambridge symposium or sometime or other, Bracewell actually claimed there was a bridge in the middle of Cygnus.
Which symposium?
I think maybe in the Paris Symposium, 1957 or 8. I remember him claiming.
I see.
He was quite sure. He'd done some measurements at Stanford on this thing, at a much higher frequency, mind you, and it could well have been that at low frequencies the thing was quite different.
Yeah.
It's a point I've always made. These measurements were made at much lower frequencies than most of the subsequent measurements. It was a long battle with Bracewell, I think.
Yeah.
It wasn't until the early 60s, when so many double sources were discovered, that I think he finally capitulated that this was on.
I have a little note here that you did not put in either of Mills's long spacing or Smith's short spacing in your model fitting, did you? Wouldn't that be a good idea to put them in?
What have we got?
See how that works?
We've got something by observation by Mills by Smith. What have we put in?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry, Smith. It's only...
Yes, there's Smith.
No, but it was only one of Smith's. Don't use Smith's point at 36 wavelengths, and Mills is at 3340. So you left out one of Smith's and one of Mills, and I was just wondering why that was. Yeah, I actually checked the details to what...
Yes, marvellous thing for you to do. I really don't know. I think the 36 one would not have meant much, would it? Because down here, that's 500 wavelengths, though you'd hardly seen it. It had been almost on the origin.
Yeah.
So I think it's reasonable to miss that one out. It doesn't contribute anything. Mills' second point is still almost at unity, if I look at it. So Smith's. Mills' point, I don't know, except that it's a long way along. Well, I think the reason may be well be this. It doesn't, on its own, so far away, how many wavelengths?
33,
yes.
40.
On its own, I think it's too big a jump to necessarily associate with this this part of the visibility function here.
But you would still want anything you do to be consistent with that point. You would still want any model you came up with to be consistent with Mills' 3300 point.
Quite true. Yes. Yeah. I can't think of any really good reason. By the way, you can see on this how the intensity interferometer wasn't all that good at measuring the visibility.
Yeah.
Smith, is it? No, that's not us. No, who's that? That's the square. That's Mills.
That's Mills' point, isn't it?
That's Mills, the old devil. He moved. Yes, so it's far too far now.
Okay, so
Yes. That came out from the other paper, actually.
You had this model. Now, it's interesting to ask you, how much do you believe in your deepest heart of hearts that there really were two sources there, especially considering that it had been identified with this half-arc minute?
That was the fascinating thing, at that point, Minkowski and Bader were talking about a double colliding galaxy object in Cygnus. But the thing was almost microscopic compared to the thing I'd measured.
You had expanding things.
I had an enormous thing compared to theirs, so that, if you like, it was even more of a chance of saying, all right, we're both getting a double object, but quite different double objects. So obviously one was not influenced by Minkowski. I was saying something entirely different. Yeah, very, very different. But what I was saying is that, all right, out there in apparently empty space, the radiation seems to be coming from these two almost symmetrical blobs.
Yeah.
What's going on? This is remarkable. There is absolutely nothing where the real signals are coming from. And the thing that Barnum Costa is seeing is coinciding beautifully with the center of gravity, but it's not coming from that.
Why didn't this kill the colliding galaxies thing very quickly? They stayed around, as you know, for many years.
Well, in those days, the big problem was ever could one get all that energy anyway? And the best source one could think of at the time was the colliding galaxies. To get enough energy, that was all.
But it would seem like if you have two things collide, the energy comes out there, not out here.
Well, fair enough. But the answer to that is fairly simple, isn't it? Even at this conference now, 25 or